Chapter 9. Annette Hudson had closely followed the Fritz trial by reading the daily reports in the Ada Evening News. On Tuesday, April 12th, the front page headline read, "Fritz Found Guilty in Carter Murder." As usual, the story mentioned her brother. Ron Williamson, who is also charged with first-degree murder in Carter's murder, is scheduled to be tried here on April 21st. In fact, all six articles covering the Fritz trial mentioned Ron's involvement and upcoming trial. How do they expect to find an impartial jury? Annette asked herself repeatedly. If one co-defendant is found guilty, how could the other one get a fair trial in the same town? She bought Ron a new gray suit, an extra pair of navy slacks, two white shirts, two ties, and new shoes. On April 20th, the day before his trial began, Ron was taken to court for a chat with Judge Jones. The judge was worried that the defendant might be disruptive, a valid concern given his history. As Ron stood before the bench, the judge said, "I want to see where we stand on your attendance tomorrow, and make sure that when you're here, that there won't be any disturbances. Do you understand my concern?" Ron, "As long as they don't start telling me that I've killed somebody." Judge Jones, "Well, you understand that they're going to do that." Ron, "Well, I understand that, but it's not right." Judge Jones knew that Ron had been a great athlete, so he used the analogy of a sports contest. It's kind of like a sporting event as far as the adversary process. Each side has an opportunity to be on offense, and they have the opportunity to be on defense, but you can't take issue with the fact that each side gets these opportunities. That's just part of the process. Ron, "Yeah, but I'm the football being kicked." For the prosecution, the Fritz trial was a nice warm-up for the main event. Virtually the same witnesses would be used, and in much the same order. But in the next trial, the state had two additional advantages. First, the defendant was mentally incompetent and prone to knock over tables and blurt out obscenities, behavior that most people, including jurors, frowned on. He could be eerily frightening. He scared people. Second, his lawyer was blind and alone. Since the court-appointed co-counsel, Baber, had withdrawn from the case April 1st, there had been no replacement. Barney was quick on his feet and a great cross-examiner, but not effective arguing over fingerprints, photographs, and hair analysis. For the defense, the trial couldn't start soon enough. Barney was sick of Ron Williamson and frustrated with the sheer number of hours the case was draining away from his other paying clients. And he was afraid of Ron, physically afraid. He arranged to have his son, not a lawyer, sit closely behind Ron at the defense table. Barney planned to sit as far away as possible, which wasn't far at all, and if Ron made a sudden aggressive move on Barney, then his son was to jump Ron from the rear and take him down. Such was the level of trust between lawyer and client. But few people in the packed courtroom on April 21st realized that the son was protecting the father from the client. Most of those present were potential jurors, strangers to such settings, and uncertain as to who was who. There were also reporters, curious lawyers, and the usual assortment of gossips that trials in small towns attract, especially murder trials. Annette Hudson and Renee Simmons sat in the front row as close to Ronnie as possible. Several of Annette's close friends had volunteered to sit with her throughout the trial and offer support. She declined. Her brother was sick and unpredictable, and she didn't want her friends to see him in cuffs and shackles. Nor did she want them subjected to explicit and gruesome testimony. She and Renee had suffered through the preliminary hearing and gotten a strong taste of what was coming at trial. There were no friends there for Ron. Across the aisle, the Carter family held down the front row, the same place they'd been during the Fritz trial. The opposing sides tried not to make eye contact. It was a Thursday, almost a full year after the exhumation of the victim's body and the arrests of Ron and Dennis. Ron's last significant treatment had been at Central State some 13 months earlier. At Barney's request, he'd been seen once by Norma Walker in Ada, a brief visit that began and ended like most of his visits to the local clinic. For a year, his medications, when he received any at all, had been erratically dispensed by the jailers. The time spent in his solitary hole in the jail had done nothing to improve his mental health. Yet his mental health concerned no one but his family. Neither the prosecution, the defense, nor the court itself had raised the issue. It was time for a trial.